Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download at www.audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Over 100,000 titles to choose from for your iPod and MP3 player. Hello and welcome to The Drill Down, the podcast where we take a look at some of the week's most important events in tech and on the web and how they affect us all. I'm Andy Cercini.
I'm Duane DeFreitas.
And I'm Tosin Unofawakin.
This week, Apple refunds customers whose kids clicked on mobile app purchases, President Obama reigns in the NSA, the end of physical film in theaters is near, Google unveils plans for smart contact lenses, and will your next Amazon package arrive before you've even ordered it? As always, you can check out past episodes of The Drill Down, as well as the other fine shows in the Geeks of Doom podcast network on geeksofdoom.com. Subscribe to us on iTunes by going to geeksofdoom.com, and our subscription link is in the right-hand sidebar. And please add us on Facebook and Twitter at The Drill Down. Our show is also on Stitcher at stitcher.com, and you can search for The Drill Down there. So let's jump into headlines here. First off, Apple has agreed to provide full refunds to customers paying a minimum of $32.5 million to settle a Federal Trade Commission complaint that the company billed consumers for millions of dollars of charges incurred by children in kids' mobile apps without their parents' consent. Under the terms of the settlement with the FTC, Apple will also be required to change its billing practices to ensure that it has obtained express informed consent from consumers before charging them for items sold in mobile apps. The FTC's complaint alleges that Apple violated the FTC Act by failing to tell parents that they that by entering a password, they were approving a single in-app purchase and also 15 minutes of additional unlimited purchases their children could make without further action by the parent. If either of you guys known anybody who has been the victim of a child's unauthorized mobile app purchase click?
Well, no one who's willing to admit it so far.
I know someone who's admitted it. I don't know. He didn't seem too upset about it. It was more goddamn kids.
Yeah. because the total of purchases he acquired is probably not as crazy as some of the other ones that came out. But I mean, the real highlight to this story is something that Google has had at the forefront of their Android technology for a while, is just the ability to, you know, set some parental controls when you give that device, or even a different user account for kids who are playing with your, you know,
right,
maybe with the parents.
Right. This has been something that's been long, you know, wished for, and
it's long overdue.
Long overdue in the iOS ecosystem is a separate user account.
Well, it goes completely against what Apple's about. As Google is a services company, they're like, okay, you have our device. Yeah, log in, log out, whatever. Apple wants an iPhone in the hands of every person. So if you're going to, you know, let somebody log into your iPad, then they sell one less iPad. And I think that's been the big sort of, like, I feel like in tech finance circles, that's kind of been the big thing. Like, the cool thing about the iPad is that everybody needs one. The iPhone is that everybody needs one.
Yeah.
But I completely agree with you. For something that's taking over the PC, right?
Yeah.
It's a family device that you pass around the living room. There's no reason why you shouldn't be able to, like, you know, put your thumbprint on and then it logs in as you. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Even Netflix lets you switch user accounts now.
Exactly. Well, they're doing that for an interesting reason. I think they're really into trying to figure out which person in the home is watching what.
Sure.
So they really want to get their hands on that data, and that's really useful. I'm surprised that Amazon hasn't gone that route too. But it looks like with this paid TV service, they're looking at something different. They have a different market strategy altogether.
Yeah, I'm glad that they're doing this. Someone broke it down and said that this basically works out to 7 minutes of app time per user, $32.5 million. So,
wow.
There you go. 7 free minutes of app usage.
7 minutes in heaven. Remember that?
Right. Moving on, in a major speech last week, President Obama took steps to reassure Americans and foreigners alike that the U.S. will take into account privacy concerns highlighted by former spy contractor Edward Snowden's damaging disclosures about the sweep of monitoring activities of by the NSA. He said, "The reforms I'm proposing today should give the American people greater confidence that their rights are being protected, even as our intelligence and law enforcement agencies maintain the tools they need to keep it safe." While the address was designed to fend off concerns that U.S. surveillance has gone too far, Obama's measures fell short of dismantling the spying programs. He promised that the U.S. will not eavesdrop on heads of state or government of close U.S. friends and allies unless there's a compelling national security purpose. He also proposed measures that would take the data accumulated by the NSA and route it through third-party networks before getting to the NSA. And instead of the NSA having that data directly, they have to request it from these third-party networks first.
I mean, is that an exciting thing for you guys? The idea that, oh, let's give the data to somebody else before the NSA gets it. I know it's a check and it's a balance, but given the security breach activity that we've seen over the last few years, the idea of one more hop is problematic to me. And also, who do we trust with it? I don't trust the NSA with it, sure, but who do we trust with it at all? And what do they get to do with it? Like, who's incentivized to just hold a whole bunch of data?
I feel like this was a... this was more like lip service than anything else. Like, I feel like this was a measure meant to sort of allay...
I'm doing something.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, that's also the whole thing with, like, there may be an advocate now for the private citizen at the FISA court when the request goes out to get the data from the right. from the individual. That's interesting to me. But frankly, you know, everything's so secret that I don't see how anyone can mount a strong defense. Hey, we need this data. Why? It's a top secret thing. Oh, mister, why don't you defend why this person should be able to hold on to their data? It's going to be the same defense every time. And is it going to work? Who knows? It's a strange situation. It feels harmful.
Yeah, and also regarding the changing the rules to not eavesdrop on heads of state or government, the proviso was unless there is a compelling national security purpose. So, I mean, that could be anything.
And also, since when are heads of state more important than U.S. citizens, right? I mean, they're still logging all the U.S. citizens. And part of the country's ideal is that all people are created equal. So... why is the head of state of some foreign country getting better privilege than I am? I get it. They're a diplomat, whatever. But at the same time, I want my government to take care of me first.
It was intended to address many complaints logged against the NSA, you know, in one sort of fell swoop, both the complaints by U.S. citizens and complaints by the heads of state of foreign nations. I don't see any specifics that tell me that the activities of the NSA are actually going to change.
I agree with you. I think that this is, what's the president to do? Presidents don't give up power. They don't say, okay, we've been doing this thing. We think it's keeping you safe, but because everybody's angry at it, we're going to stop. They don't give up power. So it's a catch-22. The biggest problem Obama finds here is that he got caught on his watch.
Right. Know? Right. Not to say that he was in particular. I mean, I think maybe he perpetuated the...
He inherited it. He didn't conceive it. There's no doubt.
Exactly.
But at the same time, like, presidents, over time, the presidential office, you know, it makes power for itself. So George Bush took this, and President Obama's going to keep this, and that's just kind of how it's going to roll. Yep. It'll take an act of a very angry Congress to do anything to begin to stop it. It also gives you some insight into the fact that there are a lot of laws that are being passed that people don't know about. And it'd be interesting to know where, you know, my senators and my congressmen fell on that law.
This is a new frontier for everybody. Yeah. You know, the way we use technology is constantly changing. It's moving very quickly. And frankly, we are the most mature society to use it. Oftentimes you see it in the hands of other societies, and it's used to great effect.
the guys who haven't developed it, things like, you know, revolutions and so on and so forth. But we are the society that's coming up with this technology and how to use it. And I feel like we should be hallmarks of the responsibility for it. You know, how we should show real promise and real leadership on how to use it responsibly. And it's unclear that we're doing that. Instead, we're just kind of showing other governments how to behave when it comes to suppressing and logging and cataloging what their citizens are doing. And I don't know that that's really where we want to be.
All right, moving on here. In a historic move, Paramount Pictures has become the first big studio to stop releasing its major movies on film in the United States. The studio's Oscar-nominated film The Wolf of Wall Street is the studio's first movie in wide release to be distributed entirely in the digital format. The decision is likely to encourage other studios to follow suit, accelerating a complete phase-out of film that could come by the end of the year. Jan Christopher Horak, director of the UCLA Film and Television Archive, said, "It's of huge significance because Paramount's the first studio to make this policy known. For 120 years, film in 35mm has been the format of choice for theatrical presentations. Now we're seeing the end of that." He says, "I'm not shocked that it happened, but how quickly it happened. Studios prefer digital distribution because it's cheaper. Film prints cost as much as $2,000, while a digital copy on disc usually costs less than $100. Eventually, these movies could be beamed in the cinemas by satellite, saving even more in production and shipping costs. Digital technology also enables theaters to screen higher-priced 3D films and makes it easier for them to book and program entertainment." So it's kind of ties into the story that we did last episode about two episodes ago about the decline of digital purchases versus streaming and the rise of streaming music purchases. It's like,
well, it shows how far behind the movie industry is. They could have been doing this kind of digital purchasing thing 10 years ago. But instead, they stuck with, you know, 35mm film.
Yeah.
Now they've got a system in place. Streaming should come fairly quickly compared. You know, these leaps happen more quickly. But I do feel like they could have gotten here sooner.
Well, we've seen over the last 10-plus years, we've seen the decline of physical film in production. Like, you know, within the course of my career in the movie industry, I've witnessed the complete death of film in film production in the actual production end, and the theatrical distribution was really like the last mile. They were the last sort of holdouts for digital distribution, and now we're seeing and all of the other studios were none of the other studios wanted to be the first one to do away with film entirely, so that was like a big game of chicken.
And yeah, like they want to be first to be second. It's crazy to me that all this production work is being done digitally, and then they put it on film.
Yeah.
That's crazy. Yeah. All right, take it to film.
Yep. I still contend, though, that film is probably the best medium to archive movies onto, because who knows how long a digital a copy of a film will last in an archival environment.
Well, it doesn't require like the infrastructure, electricity. Like you can have put a film with a really tiny amount of power on a projector and see it. When it comes to, you know, you got to power a computer when it's digital. You got to do all other stuff. Like, it's hard to resurrect catastrophically. Like if the world goes dark,
right?
Books are still going to be the best way to read.
Well, and also like movies that we thought were lost to the ages that are on the most fragile, warped film, or, you know, original film possible, we've been able to digitally scan them and enhance them and restore them to near mint quality. And that's only possible because we had the physical film to begin with. If we transfer stuff even shot digitally and distributed digitally onto physical film stored underground in a salt mine for hundreds of years, even if that film deteriorates slowly at its own rate, it's able to be restored again.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, it requires infrastructure, right? Yeah. Like, it's one of those things where if you decide to go digital for all your stuff, then you're going to need to have servers that are constantly backing up, and
right.
the drives have to be updated. And, you know, the initial cost is going to be that $100, but what's it going to be over time in order to keep your server farm running, et cetera? It's like just one of the costs of business.
Even if you put an archival copy of a digital film on a shelf, you have to ensure that it's going to be in a format that's going to be readable 100 years from now. This format.
Well, I think a big piece of that is not, like, when you go digital, you can't think I'm putting it on a hard drive and I'm going to put it in a corner. You got to think, you got to keep it cloud connected, you know. And there's some security risk for them there, but you've got to really keep it cloud connected. You've got to have it on a server farm that's constantly being maintained and updated, so you can always have access to it. It's always got to be live.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting.
Yeah, but this is the maybe old person in me. Sometimes it sort of feels like there's some nostalgia, though. I feel like we should go make a YouTube video of the good old days of film.
I mean, there's nothing to say that they can't maintain one film copy. They're just releasing it on digital, right? They could still say, okay,
but I highly doubt they will, right? Due to the cost.
They're going to archive one. Why not?
They'll archive a digital, but not film.
I mean, that's what I'm saying. Like, they might still – I mean, if I were a studio and I had – you know, distributing film is expensive because it's $2,100 or whatever per whatever. Archiving, creating one archive for the posterity, that's not a problem. That's not going to break the bank, especially because my savings on all the other distribution is fine. That's all I'm saying. Like, financially, it makes sense to archive it on digital.
Yeah, I think archiving on film is a way to ensure that you can bring it back.
I'm sorry, I got it wrong. It's financially, it still makes sense to archive it on film.
Ah,
so you distribute it digitally because it's only $100 to distribute.
Sure.
And then you put it on a film reel, just one, and put it in your particular studio's vault. It makes sense to archive it on film.
All right. So let's take a moment to talk about our sponsor, Audible.com, the world's leading provider of digital spoken word entertainment on the internet. For the listeners of the Drill Down podcast, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial to give you a chance to check out their service. And the book I'd like to highlight this week is called Quiet, The Power of Introverts in a World That Can't Stop Talking by Susan Cain. At least one-third of the people we know are introverts. Although they are often labeled quiet, it is to introverts that we owe many of the great contributions to society, from Van Gogh's sunflowers to the invention of the personal computer. If you've ever felt guilty for wanting to stay home instead of attending a party, or wish you could be more vocal and outgoing at work, this book is for you. Empowering and Informative, Quiet is a revolutionary look at the power of introverts and the strengths they contribute to society. I have recently come to an epiphany over the last year or so, something that I didn't really think about or realize until recently, but I think that I am an introvert. I never really identified with an introvert sort of lifestyle, but one of the hallmarks that I definitely identify with is that people who are extroverts at a party, they're energized by interacting with other people. And people who are introverts generally are their energy. They feel their energy sapped by having to maintain small talk, you know, and that's kind of the way I feel. Like, it's a chore for me to be actively communicative and maintain a social appearance in a large social situation.
Is there something in between?
Because it's a spectrum for sure.
Because I really feel as if I hate small talk.
I detest it.
Yeah.
All that polite nonsense. But at the same time, you know, at a party with good people, I like to learn, and I like to learn about these people and like why they're here and yada yada yada. So I just feel like I hear a lot about the, you know, this kind of dual nature, introvert, extrovert, and I really don't see a. I mean, if the book goes into spectrum, that'd be great. But yeah, I'd love to see the spectrum, because I know that as a person who talks more than they should probably, there is a part of me that spends a significant amount of time alone and in quiet.
Sure.
I need that. Sure, I really need that. And then when I'm around people, I'm slightly different. And it's like there's a lot of code shifting that goes on, I guess. So I'm excited to check this book out.
Yeah. I just started reading it now, and I'm only like in the first chapter or so. But she definitely discusses the fact that it is a spectrum, and people fall somewhere along the spectrum. It's not like black or white. So it's an interesting a book, and I'm looking forward to getting into it some more. To download that free audiobook or any one of Audible's other 10,000 plus titles, 100,000 plus titles. I always do that. It's 100. They have a ton of titles. Go to audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Again, that's audibletrial.com/thedrilldown for that free audiobook and the 30-day trial to give you a chance to check out their service. We're going to take a little break here, listen to some music, and when we return, Google moves their technology from resting on your face to in your eyes. So take a listen to this and come on back. If you're just joining us, you're listening to The Drill Down on Geeks of Doom, the roundtable podcast where we take a look at the best in tech and on the web and how it affects us. I'm here with Dwayne DeFreitas and Tosin Anafowakin. Google has been working on a smart contact lens embedded with sensors so small they look like bits of glitter and antenna thinner than a human hair. But these lenses aren't being developed to give people superhuman sight or to cast the internet over their field of view, like Google Glass. Rather, they could potentially help diabetics monitor their glucose levels. Google announced last Thursday that it's been working on this secret project at its Google X research lab. Not only has it developed prototypes of these smart contact lenses, it's also done multiple clinical research trials, met with the U.S. FDA, and is looking for potential partners to bring the product to market. Diabetes is said to be one of the fastest growing diseases in the world. According to Google, it affects 1 in 19 people around the globe. In order to keep blood sugar levels in check, diabetics must give themselves finger prick blood tests throughout the day. Using tears to measure glucose is complicated because it's been hard for scientists to collect tears for testing. So in this situation, not only does Google need to find partners to get the contact lenses to market, but also needs to go through the arduous FDA clearance process. Their contact lens prototypes squeeze a glucose sensor, antenna, capacitor, and chip between two contact lens layers in a like a sandwich. And there's a tiny hole on the eye side, on the inside of the contact lens, that allows tear film to reach the sensor. The components sit on top of a thin plastic-like film that's made of a biocompatible material, which Google is keeping that formula secret. And it holds everything together like a fiberglass circuit board traditionally would. The smart lens broadcasts its readings through radio frequencies to an external monitoring device that the test subject carries with him or her. In turn, the device powers the mechanics of the lenses through those same radio frequencies. Another blue sky project from Google X Labs. What do you guys think about this?
You know what? I mean, at first I'm like, I mean, if you know anybody who has type 1 diabetes and they have to keep, you know, basically either a needle in them, yeah, you have to prick themselves at times, this is huge. But then, like, I look at the long-term consequences. We still don't know what's going to happen to our brains with, you know, the cell phone radiation from putting these things up to our ears or holding them close to our face. I know the radio waves coming off of a contact lens can't exactly be super hardcore, but, I mean, that's a really delicate part of your body. And the idea that, like, you've got electromagnetic waves, radiation kind of going in and out of that is something that you know, I'm concerned about.
Tosin, you were about to say something?
Yeah. Apart from the concerns, I think this is sort of the direction that we kind of expected years ago, right? In terms of not necessarily moving towards something like Google Glass, but uh-huh, moving towards something where it's directly within your vision, right? Not something that, right, you actually have to pick, right, up. And with that, of course, there are the health concerns. There are also the concerns of, you know, paying attention where attention should be due.
Right.
But I think ultimately having some sort of embedded technology is kind of what I think a lot of people would appreciate, more so than having to have something physical on them, right? That's why a lot of us, from myself in particular, I moved to contacts because I do sports and do a lot of things.
Yeah.
But now I have all this other tech that I like to try and keep on me, my Fitbit for one, uh-huh, so I like try and run around. And so, you know, I've played around with a friend who was wearing Google Glass and we were trying to test it out playing basketball and other stuff, but there's still that sort of space that you need and space and desire to, you know, abstract away so that you don't damage the device, when it could be something as simple as, oh, this is, I'm using my eyes to, you know, get other data to, you know, supplement what I see in the real world.
Yeah. As a bionic and wearable goes, there's no doubt this is awesome. I mean, I use my Fitbit,
yeah,
without thinking about it, because I know it's not going to get in the way of what I want to do. And that's the problem with the Google Glass right now. Obviously, they're going to fix it up. This is also nice because you put it in your eye, you have it there, and you know, you're good. The idea that, like, you know, you'll get a little buzz if there's a problem, that's cool. But we also remember that contact lenses aren't something that you keep in your eye all day, all night. So there is that. But I do think this is the step, this is the direction that wearables need to go in. It's more than that. This is one of those things where it makes sense. The reason why you put a contact in your eye is this reason. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's not like, oh, I can just get a camera in my contact lenses. Like, that's a little creepy, whatever. But, like, I can actually, like, keep myself from getting pricked, you know, once an hour every day, twice an hour every day.
Yeah.
That's huge. That's a life-changing – that's truly a life-changing technology. So hats off, definitely. Obviously, safety and efficacy are a concern, but you know, I think I have a feeling they get around those things.
Yeah, you don't want to trade off, you know, the inconvenience of having a needle prick twice a day with potential long-term health problems due to radio waves. At the same time, you know, who knows? We're still dealing with cell phone radiation issues and whether or not those are an actual thing or not. You know, it's been hotly debated. And
Yeah, the jury is somewhat still out. The cool thing about this is that it would not necessarily have to be a lot of power to get from an eye to a pocket the way – you know, getting from a cell tower to the phone in your hand. Yeah. That's a high powered wave. So, you know, it makes us hopeful.
Speaking of things that you wear in your eye that Google makes, a man who went to the movies with his wife in Columbus, Ohio, was subjected to a terrifying hour-long interrogation by the FBI because employees at the AMC theater saw him wearing Google Glass. They apparently thought he might be illegally taping the film and didn't believe him when he tried to explain the glasses were prescription and weren't even switched on. The incident began when the man was watching Jack Ryan's Shadow Recruit with his wife.
Seriously, who wants to pirate that? Like, seriously.
Somebody approached him, shoved a badge of some sort with a shield on it, yanked the glass off his face, and told him to follow me outside immediately. He was then detained and treated like...
The glass was yanked off of his face?
Yes.
That comes across to me like a bit of an overreaction.
This was according to...
Or a violation, right?
Yeah, that's crazy.
According to the person himself whom this happened to, he says, I was searched and more stuff taken away from me, specifically my phone. After embarrassing 20, 30 minutes outside of the movie theater, me and my wife were conducted into two separate rooms into the management office of the mall, where the guy with the badge introduced himself and showed me a different ID. What followed was over an hour of the feds telling me I was not under arrest and this is a voluntary interview, but if I chose not to cooperate, bad things may happen to me.
What?
Yeah. This
I
is...
That's like very, like, anyone who's ever watched any kind of FBI situation knows, like, that's the way they're portrayed in the movies.
Yeah.
But to see that in, like, real life, I mean, what are you going to say? I know my rights? You can't say anything.
Right.
They could... spirit you away, and that'd be terrible.
Eventually, after a long time, somebody came with a laptop and USB cable, at which point he says he told me it was my last chance to come clean. I repeated for the 100th time there's nothing to come clean about, and it's a big misunderstanding. So the FBI guy finally connected my glass to the computer, downloaded all my personal photos, and started going through them one by one. Then they went through my phone, and 5 minutes later, they concluded I had done nothing wrong. So, like, we've talked about this on the show before, over a year ago, I think we talked about this when, we first started talking about Google Glass and its potential to change, the way people, the sort of the social contract that people have when they, go out in public. And we talked about the potential of this causing an uproar when people wear it in public in places like bars or in particular movie theaters. And so this is the first real life incident of this happening. I can't imagine that it's going to be the last.
And, well, I mean, it was such an overreaction by the person with, you know, so-called police authority. I'm just so surprised that this could happen.
But you know what? Doesn't this remind you of when people first started traveling with iPhones, or then with like iPads and the sort of things that some people had to go through?
Yeah.
No, this does not remind me of that at all.
You know what? I mean, not to this extent, but there are so many stories of people on the plane being like, "Hey, this is an airport plane mode," or, you know, having issues of that degree, or even people trying to go through scanners, TSA scanners, with, you know, their iPads and coming under high scrutiny and facing a lot of issues. I think you get it. Maybe not to this far-fetched extent where someone is basically detained
This was violent, and he was detained. I feel like that doesn't really happen with an iPhone or an iPad. I mean, I was in India with couple iPhones, and I had brought my older iPhone because it uses a normal SIM card, and they asked why I had it, and they talked to me for a minute, and that was fine. It was a little sketchy because I was like, are they going to take it from me? But I mean, this guy in his, you know, he's brought to a thing, and he was given the you know, the whole like come clean situation.
But I mean, I still think this is more of an edge case.
It's related, but it's ridiculous.
I think what we're going to see fairly rapidly and Google Glass may be a bad example, because who knows if Google Glass ultimately will catch on in this particular iteration. But but we're also, what we're talking about really is wearable computing in general, and any sort of device that breaks that social contract.
I mean, camera phones and the whole locker room thing was an issue for a while. The thing about most wearables today is that you don't notice that they're on people. Google Glass is ostentatious, to say the least. You know, like, everybody knows you're wearing it. It's a status symbol sort of thing.
Right.
So that's a big part of
it. And it's not going to be the only – there will be other devices that are like this that, that also break that social contract. And I think the what we're going to see pretty quickly is places like AMC establishing rules that you absolutely just cannot bring it into the theater.
Which is what happens – I mean, with your cell phone, you know, don't be that guy, because we'll ask you to leave. You know we will, kind of stuff. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And then, so that might happen. I mean, maybe they need to just put the whole thing in a Faraday chamber. Maybe when you go to the theater, you know, like, I remember there are older theaters in New York where you get no reception or anything.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's as much of a good thing as it is an annoying thing.
And really, really, they should have known that given the battery life or the Google Glass, there's no way you could record all of that data.
Yeah, the whole movie.
Well, you know, it's funny because what this reminds me of is the early days of cell phones with cameras, where you would go to a movie concert and they'd actually confiscate your phone. They'd hold onto your phone. You'd get it later after the concert, but the idea was they didn't want anyone recording any part of the concert with the phone. Now they don't care. It's so ubiquitous that they almost,
well, it's not that they don't care necessarily, it's that they have no way of stopping every single concert goer's phone. They don't have the logistics for it. And then you add to that the fact that they've seen the video people take of the concert with their phone.
Yeah.
It's not good video. It's not. Right. Even with the tightest phone, it's still a whole bunch of, like, blinking lights and, like, ambient noise.
Yeah. So do you think that wearable computing will get to the point, particularly with devices like Google Glass, where it'll be so ubiquitous and establishments like this just won't care because the output is not – is not going to be threatening their
ability to make money. I think
for now, but I mean, I think the output is, I think ultimately as a tech community, we want the output to be able to challenge their establishment. I want to be able to record for endless hours. Right. So we may need to find some.
But what I'm saying is, here's the thing. It doesn't really matter that you can record for endless hours. Cause when you look at the quality of the recording, it's nothing that's sellable. The experience inside the concert is so superior to what you've recorded that people still want to go to the concert. And that's why it's not a big deal. And
I guess that's true. It's not going to be detrimental.
Yeah, and as long as I think that can be proven, I mean, even if Google Glass has the tightest situation ever, a movie obviously is very different from a concert. But I feel as if, you know, it becomes a ubiquitous thing. They're not going to have a situation where you have to check your glasses at the door. As long as it becomes ubiquitous, they'll have to move. They'll have to figure out how to get over it, basically. Because Tosin's right. It's just, you want the stuff to work, and you want the stuff to, you know, work seamlessly, and you don't want people taking your stuff when you walk into a theater.
Right. Right.
That's crazy.
Well, although I haven't seen this movie, he probably didn't miss out.
That's what I've heard as well. No big loss. Well, you know, in any case, they did offer him 4 tickets to any future movie. So,
oh, that's great. We just stole hours of your life and, you know,
terrorized him.
Going to go good for you. Terrorized you. He should sue the ever-loving pants off these guys. He should totally be like, damages, man. I'm all stressed out now.
Well, maybe he's got some recourse. All right, moving on. According to the Wall Street Journal, Amazon knows you so well it wants to ship your next package before you order it. The Seattle retailer in December gained a patent for what it calls anticipatory shipping, a method to start delivering packages even before customers click buy. The technique could cut delivery time and discourage customers from visiting physical stores. In the patent document, Amazon says delays between ordering and receiving purchases may dissuade customers from buying items from online merchants. So Amazon says it may box and ship products it expects customers in a specific area will want based on previous orders and other factors, but haven't yet ordered. According to the patent, the packages could wait at the shippers' hubs or on trucks until an order arrives. In deciding what to ship, Amazon said it may consider previous orders, product searches, wish lists, shopping cart contents, returns, or even how long an internet user's cursor hovers over an item. It's not clear if Amazon has deployed or will deploy the technique. A spokeswoman declined to comment. This to me, like, looking at this, I feel like, okay, that makes sense. In a way, it's kind of like what Netflix does with recommendations. Their recommendations are sometimes so precise, it's eerie. And on the other hand, this also looks like one of those examples of filing a patent that's so general that it will cover any sort of future patents that come close to doing something like this.
Yeah, I mean, it's just better distribution. Hey, look, this is trending in that area. Send more.
Yeah.
I mean, you gotta protect yourself is what the current patent environment has shown us. So be it. I like the idea of anticipating stuff. I don't know about you guys, but for some reason, I am less worried about Amazon having my information than some other tech vendors out there. You know, I give them a lot of information. I purchase directly from them, through them.
Yeah.
I feel like it's relatively secure. And I don't know what they've done because I don't see a lot of Amazon commercials in the world. But I feel like they have my best interest as a consumer at heart. Maybe it's because the transaction I have with them is purely monetary, is primarily mm-hmm. monetary mm-hmm. and only secondarily data-driven, right? They're not monetizing my data with a third party directly. But for whatever reason, you know, I'm sort of like, oh, drone, oh, read my mind. Okay, whatever, Amazon. And I wonder what it is about them that leads me to have that kind of trust.
It's probably a lot of it's based on past experience with them. Like, how many times has Amazon ever steered you wrong?
Yeah, it's true.
Yeah, it's true. Haven't really screwed up yet.
That's what it comes down to. And they have a very long track record. Amazon's older than Google. Amazon's way older than Facebook.
Mm-hmm. That's right. They were in the book game for a long time before they got into the everything game.
Yeah, and you know, they were a little sketchy for a while. They did sell email addresses to affiliates for a bit in the early part there. So it's just funny how they've managed to maintain maybe not a squeaky clean, but a relatively clean image. And I guess because they're constantly surprising us with new products and new ideas, we can't. There's not a lot of meditation on their problem. What's problematic about them, if anything?
I can easily see the first implementation of this being where, you know, there's already a service on Amazon where you can schedule a regular delivery of certain items.
Kitty litter.
Yeah, exactly. That's one example. But for people who haven't participated in that, where they notice that someone buys kitty litter every month or so on a regular basis, they'll just end up shipping the next another shipment of kitty litter to them automatically based on their previous purchases, which, you know, that could be helpful. Okay, we're going to take one last break. And when we come back, HBO not only doesn't care that you're sharing your HBO Go passwords, for them, it's good business. Our drill down video of the week. Take a listen to this and come on back.
Baby, if you give it to me, I'll give it to you. I know what you want. You know I got it. Baby, if you give it to me, I'll give it to you. As long as you want, you know I got it.
Baby, if you give it to me, I'll give it to you. I know what you want.
For a few years, shed a few tears, called each other nickname like Sugar Plum and Pooh Bear. I'm always on the road, hardly ever home. Always busy this, busy that, can't talk on the phone. I know you aggravated, walk around frustrated. Patience getting short, how longer can you tolerate it? Listen, mom, just motivated. I do this for us, stuck on the grind, trying to elevate it.
Hey,
now.
Yo, to really be honest, you stuck with me through my whole struggle. Can't even express the words how much the kid loves you. I'ma stand as a man, never a above you. I could tell that you different from most, slightly approach you. And the ill shit about it, we don't sex every day, but when we sex, we tease in a passionate way. Love the way you touch it, those little elaborate ways. Got the guard feeling released to relax for the day. It's on you,
baby,
ma.
If you give it to me, I'll give it to you. I know what you want, you know I got it. Baby, if you give it to me, I'll give it to you. As long as you want, you know I got it.
Baby,
you're listening to The Drill Down on Geeks of Doom. I'm Andy Cersini. I'm here with Dwayne DeFreitas and Tosin Anafawakin. Did you think you were getting away with something by saving $150 a year while using your friend's HBO Go login instead of subscribing to HBO yourself? As it turns out, HBO not only doesn't mind that you're using someone else's login to stream its pay TV content for free, it wants you to. According to the company's CEO, HBO's CEO Richard Plepler told BuzzFeed this during a recent interview.
Another thing about HBO Go that I'm sure you're aware of and seems like you've actually turned a blind eye to, but I'm sure a lot of people in this audience actually partake in it, is the sharing of passwords. Somebody put up a tweet the other day that to the effect of, my sister broke up with her boyfriend, so now I can't get her parents' password to access HBO Go, you know, stuff like that. I mean, people are clearly doing this. And you've kind of taken a hands-off approach. Why is that?
A couple points. First of all, it's not material to our business, number one. It's not that we are unmindful of it, but it has no real effect on the business. Here's, you know, I go around and talk to a lot of intern groups over the course of the year. And I do my own little mother-in-law surveys, my own little focus groups. So how many people here are watching HBO Go, you know, all the hands go up. Are you watching Girls? All the hands go up. Are you watching Thrones? All the hands. Are you watching Eastbound? All the hands go up. How many people are using their parents' Go account? Every hand, you know, goes up. How many of you are more likely, when you get your first apartment, to subscribe to HBO Go because you're not? All the hands go up. So to us, it's in many ways a terrific marketing vehicle for the next generation of viewers, and it is actually not material at all to our business growth.
So the strategy is you ignore it now on the hopes that they'll subscribe later.
It's not that we're ignoring it and we're working at different ways to affect password sharing. I'm simply telling you it's not a fundamental problem, and the externality of it is that it presents the brand to more and more people and gives them an opportunity, hopefully, to become addicted to it. And what we're in the business of doing is building video addicts. And the way we do that is by exposing our product and our shows and our brand to more and more people.
Wait, does it sound like they're maybe transforming and looking towards the future? And by the way, isn't this what people have been saying a lot about piracy in general?
No, I don't think it's that simple, Tosin. I mean, it's not a question of we're transforming by letting you, like, you know, share your passwords, and that's the new marketing model.
Right. I think it's a step. But
I mean, that's not the end goal, though. To say that the end goal should be that we get it for free just speaks to a generation that doesn't understand the value of things. It costs money to make programs. You have to spend money to get to see the programs. It's as simple as that. HBO has, in the past, relied on a model that was tied to cable, and the fact is, the cable box is something that a whole entire family looks at. If you're taking your mom's password and you're looking at it, you know, it's definitely an incremental growth that they're not seeing immediately, but they also understand that as you get addicted to the shows, it's almost like a free trial for you. They will get you sometime later, and if during this experimental phase, they don't figure out exactly how to get you sometimes later, you know, then they'll lose. But I think what's really happening is that by getting as many people to use the HBO Go service as possible, they are silently conducting a test that allows them to see how popular that is and to test the waters when it comes to offering it as a standalone service. Now, he's not going to say that in an interview, but that data is clearly being collected, seeing how many connections are happening. So we know that, you know, this many people
have a password, and yet we have this many connections. So there's a lot of sharing going on, but this ultimate number of connections is people who are truly interested. And just like, you know, Netflix or something else, we can perhaps offer this as a standalone service without the tied-in cable subscription. Now, will that happen soon, ever, never? I don't know. But I do feel as if what they're saying here is we're not going to chase down people for sharing this password situation, or at least not right now. But we are looking to it because there's significant data here. And the more people watch the show and the more people talk about the show and the more people get water coolery around the show,
yeah,
the more successful the show is, regardless of direct revenue. And that's a big piece of someone's ability to say, hey, let's put like $4 million per episode into Game of Thrones. Everybody's talking about it.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think part of it is really due to, you know, making sure that you have quality programming. If you trust the programming that you have, then you will be able to, at least this is my opinion, that, you know, if you trust your programming, you're going to be able to get subscribers. And I think that's kind of what we've seen. If you trust the programming and also have a model in which users can easily access it, I think it's those two things that hand in hand. And that's why we've seen the successes from Netflix. And I think that's also partially why HBO has always had that success, right? They've always had at least some sort of quality show. I think what they've been really needing to work on is that model of making sure that it's sort of independent and easy to provide users. And so I think that's when I really speak generally about, you know, HBO's focus being more futuristic, I don't necessarily mean that, hey, everyone needs to have this stuff for free, because, you know, like you said, people got to pay their bills, right? But it clearly it makes sense to, you know, if you give people a taste of what you're offering, and that's also kind of Netflix's model for the longest time, right? All these like free month trials that you see right. them like advertising everywhere. Right.
Give these people a taste.
Yeah, that's how I started with Netflix. I'm pretty sure I had a free trial. I'm pretty sure most people I know had a free trial before they leaped in.
Yeah, that's how I started. First taste is
free. Yeah, man. That's how I started with Amazon Prime. Got a free year because I had an EDU account. And then next thing I know, every January I'm getting charged $80. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I appreciate, like, I don't know where this stance will end up with HBO, but I appreciate the fact that they acknowledge that people are both swiping each other's passwords, using each other's passwords for HBO Go, and openly pirating shows like Game of Thrones and are not...
But it's not openly pirating. That's the difference. To openly pirate would be to download a show and distribute it again. They're not doing that. They're just gaining access to HBO through a channel or a means that HBO has said is okay.
Sure. You know? I'm referring
There's
to...
There's no... You know, that's... you're referring to not HBO
I'm,
Go?
I'm referring to earlier comments that the same CEO of HBO made that he feels that pirated... That the... pirating of Game of Thrones on sources like Pirate Bay are not he encourages it and are not again detrimental to their business.
Mm. Sounds very much like the Adobe guys back in the early 2000s saying, "Hey, look, the more people use our product for free because they're stealing it, the more businesses have to pay for it later." When these guys only know our product when it comes to doing it. Now, I don't know if HBO can claim that particular model, but that's certainly something that that Adobe leadership was saying back in the 2000s.
Uh-huh.
You know, now they've got the subscription model because, like Netflix and everything else, subscriptions are the way to go.
Okay, so I think that wraps our show up for this week, with the exception of going around the table. I'm going to start with you, Dwayne, and ask you where you can, people can find you on the internet when you're not here on the Drill Down.
You can always find me on Twitter, twitter.com/DwayneD. You can also check out everything I do on flavors.me/DwayneD. And I'm here on the Drill Down week after week.
Tosin, how about yourself? Where can the people find your work on the internet?
You can find me at Twitter at Toast4321. You can find other ramblings at IRCwebcast.blogspot and my new blog, which documents the process of my R2D2 at toastr2d2.tumblr.com.
Yeah. Yeah, I love it. I'm looking forward to more posts from you. I'd love watching the process. I can't wait.
I've got quite a few lined up that I've been meaning to write up. So,
cool. As for myself, you can find me at MrBabyMan.com, Twitter and Facebook at MrBabyMan. That's my internet, my social network handle. As for the drill down, if you've got an idea for a story you think we should be talking about, tweet us or email us at comments@thedrilldown.com. If you've got a viewpoint on any of the stories we've talked about or any issue that pertains to technology, social media, or geek culture, send that story to submissions@thedrilldown.com for us to publish on The Drill Down. Let The Drill Down podcast help you reach the targeted tech-savvy market of influencers and outliers that is our amazing audience by writing to us at sales@thedrilldown.com for details. And be sure to catch us next week at the same time and location. And that's it for this episode of The Drill Down. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks.